The views and opinions expressed by the Should They Watch It podcast are those of two moms who happen to be a registered play therapist and a voice actor for cartoons. So while they may feel their opinions come from a knowledgeable place, they are still, in fact, just opinions. Should They Watch It? A podcast that takes the task of reviewing your kids' favorite shows off your to-do list. Hey, and welcome to the Should They Watch It podcast. I'm Kara Edwards.
And I'm Laura Orr.
And today we're talking about... The Never-Ending Story!
That's right, we're covering a classic today. Man, that song was a chart topper.
Yeah, it was.
It was like number one all across the globe.
Really?
No. I didn't realize. I mean, not here, but...
Spain, everywhere but here.
Sweden. I think it was like, what, number four here. That's pretty high, though.
That's
top five.
A big deal.
Yeah, top five.
Because that would have, let's see, when the movie and song would have come out in...
84.
84.
Yep. Okay. 1984. Magical year, the year I was born.
Really? The year you were born, I would have been seven.
Aww.
Yeah, so...
So this was... I mean, probably a huge deal when you...
A huge deal. Like, I remember vividly watching it at 7.
Yeah.
And at 8, and at 9, and at 10. Ooh, and yeah, no, amazing. This was one of my favorite movies, and good gracious, did I want a Falcor.
Oh, my gosh, right?
Yeah.
A dog dragon? Are you kidding me?
Like, coolest ever.
Who did not want a dog dragon?
Yeah, so it was really fun to sit down with Michael, who's coming up on 76 and a half, and watch it. He and I had actually watched this together when he was, like, 4.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't have the same impact as it did this time.
Oh, okay. It hit him different.
Totally hit
him different. It hit me different. I'm not going to lie. I don't remember when I watched this the first time. It obviously came out when I was born, so I didn't see it till later. But my brother is actually 7 years older than me, and I know he was watching it when it came out. But I remember loving it back then. But it definitely affected me much differently now, than it did then, just because of all of the messages of the movie,
the symbolism. And also, like, that giant message at the end of the movie was like, whew,
yeah,
given everything that we've been through in the past like 5 years as a country, I feel like that was so much more powerful for me, watching it this time around.
Did you watch any of the sequels?
No.
Okay. None? Not even the second one?
I probably did as a kid, but I have no memory of it. And I definitely have not as an adult.
Okay. The second one was a huge deal for me, too. It came out in 1990.
Okay.
So I was about 6 years old. And so I loved the sequel as well. It had Jonathan Brandis in it, who was a huge deal when I was a kid. Do you know Jonathan Brandis?
Nope.
Girl. Okay. So he was, did you ever see the movie The Ladybugs? It had, it had Rodney Dangerfield in it.
Okay.
And now that I mention it, super problematic movie. But Rodney Dangerfield, I don't remember why he did this, but he ended up coaching a soccer team and having, I'm reaching way back into the depths of my brain, but I loved this movie growing up. I think he gets his girlfriend's son to dress up like a girl and join the soccer team. And Jonathan Brandis. And I had a huge crush
on him. So that would be probably a movie that would not play well today.
No, I don't even think we need to cover it at all as a Should They Watch It.
I haven't even seen it, and I can just say no.
Yeah, you could probably, I mean, I'm guessing, and it's Rodney Dangerfield, and I don't know about that. That's already going to be problematic. No, look at that face. You don't remember this guy?
I mean, maybe?
He was like, were you a Tiger Beat girl at all?
No.
Oh, girl. Okay.
I think I must have probably been onto, like, other things.
Other things, yeah. So Tiger Beat was, like, this magazine that was kind of like the People magazine for kids.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And it had all these dreamboats on it. And he was one of them. And I had him on my walls for sure.
Okay. I was at the age that the original one, when it came out, Atreyu was like, I remember probably my first crush.
Really?
Yeah.
I am not surprised. He is a dreamboat.
Like, he even watching it now, but I was so uncomfortable watching it as an adult because they kind of sexualize him. And I don't even you kind think? Of. I mean,
keeping his shirts open? Like, they couldn't. Michael even asked me, like, could they not have given him buttons? Like, why is his shirt open the whole time? He was so disturbed by the fact there were no buttons on Andrea's shirt. And I was like, yeah, buddy, I don't know.
That's interesting. I never thought about it like that.
It was slightly uncomfortable for me this time around where it was like, maybe the children didn't have to be quite so... No,
they didn't need to expose their...
Not quite so pow-pow. You know? But that said...
Pow-pow. Oh my... that's what my heart was doing watching that, for sure.
He's so cute. But I did remember, oh, goodness, did I remember my serious crush on him. So oh, yeah. I feel like we should just dive straight into our review of this movie. And then we're going to talk about a show that's just come out on Netflix afterward.
Absolutely,
and so I'm going to start with... Our big question is the never-ending story. Laura, should they watch it?
I am giving you a heartfelt yes.
Aww.
Even though it has one of my least favorite / most anxiety-producing concepts in film / TV.
Well, I can't wait to hear more about that.
You've already heard about it. Animals in Peril.
Oh.
I get so anxious when an animal is in danger, and I would say one of the most iconic scenes in this movie.
No question. I remember bawling.
Oh, yeah. It involves a horse, Atreyu's poor horse, Artex, just straight up dying. Not a slow death, but the buildup is slow.
And emotional. Yeah. I mean, that really affected me as a kid.
As a kid, it did. I was wondering if it affected you more as a
kid. I also grew up with horses. Like, that. I had a pet horse when I was 7 years old. So, like, I rode horses from the before I could walk. That one, I remember that having an enormous impact. And it was funny watching it the second time around because I was like, wow, I remember that being so much more dramatic. Now it kind of feels like it goes kind of quick and it comes at the beginning of the movie and you're like, wait, what? The horse is dead?
So it hit you more intensely as a kid then?
Yeah.
It hit me more intensely as an adult.
Okay.
Yeah, I was crying.
Aww.
I'm glad. I watched it by myself first and then I watched it with Daphne. And it was weird. She needed me to explain it to her that the horse was dead. I don't know why. I think it's because they don't actually see the horse. We don't actually see the horse going under in the mud. And so she was like, wait, what just happened? Once it cuts away.
Yeah.
And so I had to explain it to her. But it didn't affect her as much as it affected me when I watched it. I definitely cried. I will say.
Michael was kind of like, meh. He just said, he's like, did that horse just die? I was like, it did. And he's like, huh.
Both of our kids just needed clarification.
Yeah.
Like, wait a second.
I think they're inundated with so many, things that, that was really a big deal, seeing an animal die. I know when I was a child, there wasn't that much of that on TV. I mean, I guess there was Old Yeller and stuff, but... Mm-hmm. I think the kids are just exposed to so much now that they're like, meh, okay, so we didn't even see it die.
It's that Lion King thing we talked about way back in the day that, death did not hit me like it does now as a kid. And I don't know if it's because they're so far removed from it being as young as they are, and maybe the closer you get to it, it hits you different. I don't know, but... As a kid, I saw death on TV and it didn't bother me nearly as much as it hits me now. I get a lot more emotional for sure. So yeah, seeing that animal in the mud was real freaky to me.
By the way, you haven't asked me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You're so right. Kara.
I want to give my opinion.
How absolutely rude of me. You know, this has to be my unconscious brain being like,
are you scared I'm going to say no?
Because we've had a rough month, Kara.
We have not agreed on much this month.
We've either agreed that we hated something or one of us loves something and everyone doesn't. So I'm really scared because I love this so much. Kara.
Mm-hmm.
Should they watch it?
Yes.
Okay.
You know what? I really felt there is so little in this that's going to be problematic for me. Literally, for me, the thing that drove me the most crazy was the transitions in the movie, because we've come such a long way with our technology and our understanding of how stories are told, that the editing is very much 1984, and it jumps very quickly from scene to scene, and sometimes in a way that can be confusing, because we're used to being guided through our movies.
Yeah,
and this one is like, next scene, next scene, next scene, cut, cut, cut. And so as someone who loves audio and film, and also, like, Zach and I were laughing a lot because we could definitely see the ADR, which is when an actor comes in and records the dialogue after it's been filmed.
Yes. I'm pretty sure the entire film was done.
Yeah,
that way.
The lip sync is really off in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And so the technology of it, the tech side of it, was what bothered me. But the storyline, I felt the message that was being told is a really good and important message for kids. And and it's a story that, yeah, there's a little bit of violence, but it's not graphic like we see in a lot of stuff today. And I'm a definite yes.
You're a yes. Yeah. Fun fact. Did you know this movie was edited by Steven Spielberg?
sorry, master. You did a real crap job on this one.
Ooh.
I mean, fact though, Laura, anybody who watches it, obviously... that's what I'm saying. And if you go back and watch so many of his movies, like, you can see the progression of how great he's become. Because even thinking of, like, Close Encounters of the Third Kind and so many of those movies back in the 80s.
Yeah.
E.T., like, again, when you see it today, we've just come so far.
For sure. Yeah. I will agree with you.
But I mean, sorry, Mr. Spielberg. You are the best.
Get it together, Steve.
I mean, but
jeez Louise.
You kind of crapped on this one, dude.
Were you doing it in your sleep? My goodness.
Were you doing this in an iMovie?
Golly. Drink some coffee first, sir. My gosh. Skip your smoothies and get some oatmeal in there. I mean, the energy.
You need some protein.
You need some protein in there.
Oh, my Lord.
Anyways, should we say the premise?
Yeah, you go ahead. I want you to tell everyone what it's about, because I see your dreamy eyes when you talk about
this
movie.
I really do have dreamy eyes. I want to go back. I will say, like, I did say that I don't like animals in peril, but I will say this is one of the most moving scenes in the movie. Like, the message of what happens, like, when you let sadness consume you.
Yes.
And that hopelessness that comes with feeling sad or depressed, and how difficult it is to try to help someone out of that struggle. Mm-hmm. Like, it's throughout this one scene. And then it cuts to the boys, who are both showing this incredible, beautiful emotion.
Healthy emotion.
Yes. Their reaction to the grief was just so moving to me that it was just such an important part of the film. Anyways, I just had to say that because I didn't want people to think I didn't like that scene.
Right. But and it is an important, and it is hard to watch. Like, it is a very sad scene. But yes, the messages, and that gave, that's what I felt like this movie gave Michael and me so much to talk about throughout, because it was like, because he did ask, like, why did the horse die? And I said, because the sadness overtook him. And it gave us to, like, there's so much mental health that you can talk about because of this movie.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so I'll say what it's about. The movie is based off of a book, The Neverending Story, and it follows Bastian as he navigates the circle of loss, love, endings, and beginnings through a symbolic storytelling of his healing journey through grief, which I don't think everybody picks up on the symbolism of the movie. I asked Daphne straight up, what is this movie about? And she just kind of giggled and looked at me.
She's like, a dragon that flies?
Basically. A little boy who rides on a dragon and a princess.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it. And then I went and asked my husband what it's about. And
And he's like a dragon that flies.
Exactly. And I will say he didn't watch it again. So he kind of was pulling from his childhood memory. And he was like, oh, you know, it's just about this boy who goes on who reads a story about another boy who goes on an adventure to save Fantasia. And I was like, yeah, I mean, that is what it's about. And then I started telling him like what it's about. And I don't think Daphne didn't realize it even right after watching it. And my husband didn't realize it in recalling what the movie was about, that Bastian's mom was dead.
Right.
And there was this big conversation about it at the beginning. So it was, you know, it was kind of went over both of their heads. And so as much as I loved all of the meaning behind the movie, I think, you know, it's not going
it's lost in a lot of areas.
It can be, I think, unless you're, you know, I don't know.
Well, you have to really be paying attention to that opening scene between Bastian and his dad. Mm-hmm. And that scene bothered me so much today.
Yeah.
Because I know that's how my mom and my dad would have handled something in 1984 is like, you need to get your feet on the ground. I know this is hard, but you got to get through it. And that's how I was raised, is not to process your grief, but just get through it.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of a hard scene to watch where I'm like, seriously, Dad? And even Michael was like, his dad's kind of mean. And yes. I was like, yeah, he is. I said, he is being mean because, you know, and Michael had, I will say, Michael had more questions through this movie than anything he and I have ever watched on television.
Did he understand all of the
I don't think he would have understood to the level that, like, you're going to understand it. But yeah. I actually do think he got quite a bit of it because he was like, so his mom is dead? Why is his dad being mean? Why is this happening? Like, he had a lot of, why is that horse going down like that? Why is there a wolf? Why are there, what is the nothing exactly? How does that work? And, you know, so I feel like it gave us so many avenues to talk about grief and mental health and how they're handling things. And the big one for him and Laura, he has probably asked me this question 10 times in the past week.
Oh, wow.
Is he has said, I don't understand why the rock guy at the end, he just decided to let the nothing overtake him.
Oh.
He's like, why did he just sit there? Why didn't he do something? That has bothered him so much.
What do you say?
You know, and I said, you know what? Because he had lost all of his friends. He had lost his home and he gave up hope. And that's why there's that whole conversation at the end about hope, because he had lost the hope and he no longer cared.
Yeah.
And I was like, and then what we saw at the end was if he had had the hope and if he would have just hung in there, it did all work out in the end. So he should have gotten up and fight, but it was just too hard for him. Oh, okay. That's what I say.
Man, life's a beat down.
I mean, this movie. I mean, thank goodness for Falcor, you know?
A little bit of luck.
A little bit of luck.
A little winky wink Falcor.
A little bit of happiness.
I gotta say, and I've always felt this way, and man, I don't even know if I should say it, but I'm just gonna say it. I love Falcor. Totally would love to have a Falcor, but his scales always kind of grossed me out.
His scales.
It's something I want to put lotion on.
But he's a dragon. It doesn't look like to have scales.
It doesn't look like dragon scales to me.
Well, okay, but if they only had fur, then he would have just been a stuffy. He needs a flying stuffy, but then he couldn't have been called a luck dragon because there would have been nothing dragon about him. He needed the scales, even though, keep in mind, 1984, they didn't have CGI to go in and make beautiful dragon scales.
And I appreciate...
Somebody sewed that mess together, Laura.
I appreciate the mess. I'm not saying they need to change it. I'm just saying something about those scales gave me, even as a kid, a little bit of like gaggy gag feelings.
So you would not have wanted to ride on Falcor because of his scales that you would have had to have touched.
I would have avoided the scales. Okay. I feel like Falcor is equal parts hair and scale. Yeah. That I could have been like, okay, not going to put my hands there.
I'm just going to ride your face.
Over here. Oh, Kira. That's for a different podcast, my friend. No. Nope. The sound of the clapping is Kara's attempt.
I am going to edit the snot out of that.
Please don't. You can't.
All right, fine.
You mustn't.
Ooh. Oops, sorry, everybody.
Okay, where? I don't know where I was.
Yep.
You know, it kind of reminds me of when I had a dog. She didn't have mange, but she had mange as a puppy, and it kind of made parts of her skin kind of gross. And I just remember I would pet her, and I would avoid certain spots.
Laura, you cannot compare Falcor's scales to mange.
What
is happening? This podcast has gone to a weird place.
I can't help it. My glass is fogged up.
Okay.
Since we're in a weird place, did you think the intro was a little long? It was like 3 minutes of the nothing, just like sandscape.
Oh, absolutely. This goes back to my whole editing issue.
It's a weird choice,
it's
right?
It's an absolute weird choice. I wonder if Steven Spielberg would have done this movie today, like if he did a remake of this movie, how he would do it differently. It would be fascinating to see this movie in modern times with CGI and all the things we know about movie making today.
Man, I would be really sad about that, though, because one of the things I love, love, love about this movie is the puppetry and all of the detail.
The simplicity of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
lovely.
And it's just, it's a lot like The Dark Crystal and The Labyrinth, in my opinion, in that you can watch it and you don't feel like you're watching something, in my opinion, like dated as so much as you're watching like something that is a classic, and this approach to storytelling through the visuals no longer exists, but it's still so thoughtfully done and well done that it's something you can appreciate even now. I will say the movie's 95 minutes long. You can stream it Amazon Prime, Roku, Redbox, Apple TV, and Vudu.
And it's worth it. It's actually worth it.
Just fast forward through the first 3 minutes of the nothing. It's really weird. Do you remember moving sand art? I think it's called Sandscapes. You flip it. It's like this sand trapped in glass, and you flip it and there's bubbles holding it up.
Yeah.
It's kind of what it reminded me of.
It's probably what they used, Laura. They probably stuck a camera up against Sandscapes and then just flipped it over. And then that's how they made this stuff. They didn't have the technology. So there's no telling what they did to do that. And there were little things throughout. You know, if you have super young children, there's going to be parts that are scary. I know when Michael and I watched it, I want to say he was like maybe four the first time we watched it, and it scared him. There were parts, the thing that got him the most were the two statues when...
the Sphinx statues?
Yes, the Sphinx statues when you have to be... fully confident in yourself, you have to believe in yourself to be able to make it through. Right. And they kill a guy. They kill a soldier that's trying to get through, a knight. And that bothered Michael so much when he was young. He was scared, turn it off. I don't like this movie. Falcor scared him. The wolf, he didn't understand the wolf. Everything was really scary. Watching it now, nothing scared him. He was super into it. Again, he just had a gazillion questions. One of my favorite things he did actually comment on was he was trying to figure out why Bastion was up in the attic of the school. And like, do all schools have an attic? And do they all look like that? He was really interested in that. And then when it started showing what was actually in the attic and it showed all of the skeletons, he got weirded out by that. And he actually asked me, are those skeletons all of the school's victims?
The school's victims?
Like, oh my God, no, I don't know what they are. It's like, I think they're for science class. Doesn't have victims.
If you misbehave, you go in the attic.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then, like, when he threw the book, when Bastion throws the book because he just gets overwhelmed by everything, that's Michael's new favorite word is yeet. So he was really wondering, why did he yeet the book?
He yeeted it hardcore,
He yeeted
too,
the book. Yeah. Why? Why? Yeah. So it was, I mean, the whys throughout were intense.
So many questions. Yeah, there was a website I read about the symbolism, and the symbolism behind the attic is supposed to be representing how Bastian felt on the inside. Just
he had just, victims.
Serial killer.
Okay.
Yeah.
poor Bastian.
You know, it's a very empty room, it is very empty. It's surrounded by all this dark imagery. So the audience, it is about children, but I really enjoyed it. I think it's for kids of all ages, but like Kara said, there are scary moments.
Yeah, super young kids, it might be a little scary. Wait till they're old enough to, again, I feel like this is a movie you can use as an avenue to talk about so many different things. If you are given the wishes that Bastian's given at the end, when the wishes he makes, that Fantasia becomes more and more beautiful and more alive, the more wishes he makes. So I did ask Michael, if you were Bastian and you were given all of these wishes, what would you wish for? And the first thing he said he'd wish for was a snake, which of course he would. The second thing he'd wish for is for all Pokemon to be real.
Oh, all of them?
Yeah.
Are they all good?
I know. But then he just wants to live in a world where Pokemon are real. And he's like, and then I would wish for all the Pokeballs to catch them all.
Oh, then he could have a room full of Pokemon.
Yeah. So if this ever came to life, that's where we'd be in Michael's world.
How many Pokemon exist?
Oh, God, thousands.
Thousands. So he would have a bunch of Pokeballs. He would need a room for it. He'd be like Scrooge McDuck swimming around in Pokeballs.
Swimming around in his Pokeballs with all his little Pokemons.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I like the idea, though, of the more you wish and dream, the more beautiful
Fantasia things become. Mm-hmm. And it is about hopes and dreams. And they talk so much at the end when the wolf, I didn't totally understand the wolf's role, but he has such a great speech at the end.
Yeah, it's the more people lose hope, the easier they are to control.
That's powerful.
Yeah, it's a huge one. There's some really powerful things said throughout the movie, but the symbolism of the movie, it's really, there's so much to it. Practically everything in this movie has symbolism, so we won't be able to cover all of it today. But if anyone is curious about the bigger symbolism in the movie, you can check out an awesome article I read from Cinerama Film. It's called The Neverending Story, A Fantasia of Grief and Recovery. And discussion of it is that the wolf is death,
okay,
and the nothing is grief. So that is why the wolf is helping the nothing, because it is bringing the grief, or it is helping the grief because it is death. There's this part when Atreyu is injured that I thought was really awesome. He goes to the couple. I don't remember their names.
Oh, the doctor couple?
Yes.
Yeah.
The woman, she asks Atreyu if he's hurt, and he says no. And she says, well, it has to hurt in order for it to heal.
Yeah, that stuck out for me too.
And I thought that was really powerful, considering we are watching Bastian basically, you know, explore his own grief.
Yeah.
And I know that can be so hard when you're grieving, or when you're going through something difficult, or have experienced something that's really emotionally taxing on you, that it's easy to just try to ignore the hurt or do something to distract yourself from it. But, you know what can kind of happen to you if you don't
explore that. Yeah, and process and go through it.
Yeah. And so
feel the hurt.
This movie has a lot of heart. I would say it is a fluffy movie.
But it can be used to be very educational if you want to use it as a doorway to talk about some of this stuff.
There are just so many existential conversations to be had with this. And also, like you said, about mental health and grief.
Yeah.
For sure. Will parents like it?
I loved it. Yeah. I've loved watching it as a kid and as an adult.
Yeah. I think I loved it too. I think the way that it's made is very smart. Because as a kid, you just you'll see it in a different way every time you watch it as you grow older.
Yeah.
You said earlier you did kind of a deep dive on the actors.
Yeah. So
I'm jumping around a little bit, but
yeah, Zach and I were interested because I was like, I remember hearing, because you know, Atreyu was so many of our first crushes that it was like, where is he at today? Yeah. So I will say this, the actors from this movie, I don't believe any of them went on to do a lot of other movies or acting or roles. They have all gone on to do different things that are really interesting and
get. It sounds like it was by choice. I don't.
Yeah,
think
I'd, get different yeah. degrees and do amazing things in their lives. Some of them are on the con circuit. I have not personally met any of them, but yeah, it's interesting. They nobody looks as you'd expect, but then none of us do.
Right. Right. Well, that's the truth. I mean, you look at these. I mean, I think I could see a lot more of Noah. What's his last? The person who played Atreyu.
Yeah.
I feel like I could see that in him. But the guy who played Bastion, I was like, that does not even look like him at all.
The picture I saw, I'm like, you, that's a lot more beard.
So much beard.
So much more beard.
And I'm pretty sure dreadlocks.
and yeah.
You would not put the two and two together at all.
Fascinating.
It was very interesting to see.
It makes me hope that at some point I land at a convention that they're at.
Oh, my gosh.
Because that would be really fun and interesting.
I think they both live in L.A., so if you ever go to a L.A. convention, you should check and see. It was pretty...
I'm always fascinated, and I guess I admire so much... young children actors who do go on to, like, you know what? No, I don't think I'm going to follow the pathway of acting because it is such a difficult business and it really can tear you down. So I'm always fascinated, like, no, I'm going to go on and get this degree or go do these other things and live this, like, totally different life.
Yeah.
And yet you will be known throughout your entire existence as this one role.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why they are at the conventions.
Yeah.
They also got a little introduction into it, too, when none of them were cast in the sequel. That was not...
Right.
That wasn't their choice. That was because they wanted to keep Bastion the same age, and so they couldn't pick kids that were in their teens for the role. And so none of them got recast for that reason. And so
every child actor's been through it. Mm-hmm. It happens in voice acting too, where someone gets cast to voice a young character and then they age out, their voice changes, and then they have to get, usually at that point, they just go to a girl if it's a boy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I really like that movies from the 80s have a lot more calm moments and they spend more time at the beginning of the movie to kind of create a scene that
instead of just diving straight into the drama.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And so that happens in this movie that I really, and I think that gives more, that they also give more dialogue to the actors.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that about the movies, and this movie has that, and I like that, and I don't see that as much currently. I really like that it encourages a love for reading.
Yeah.
It shows how exciting it can be to immerse yourself into a story.
And that you become a part of the story as you're reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
It becomes a part of your story.
Yep.
Michael did ask, because he kept asking in the beginning, why is it called Neverending Story? And I said, ask me again at the end. And we did talk about that. I was like, did you get it? Did you get that, you know, when you read a book, that becomes part of you and you become part of a never-ending story because it goes and goes and goes. And he was like, oh, wow.
So meta, man.
Wow.
It's so deep.
Dude.
Bro. Daphne and I had a chat about which we would rather have as a pet between the racing snail or the flying bat.
You mean the dumb bat that bothered Michael that they kept calling him the stupid bat?
I know. That
Why was is gonna... he stupid? I'm like, he's not stupid. They're just mean.
They are kind of mean. He just, he does fall asleep. He has narcolepsy. That's for sure.
He's a bat.
I mean, in the end, we chose Falcor, obviously. A lot more trustworthy, that guy.
Definitely trustworthy. He's going to have your back.
Even though he does need a trip to the dermatologist, but that's fine. So you talked a little bit about Dad. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I don't think he handled that situation very well. I think, it, like you said, it's pretty reminiscent of the time. This idea of just, like, move on, you know, push it inside. There's something that I feel like happened a lot more back then of this message being, like, parents just don't understand. And
right.
There's this divide between adults and kids. And I get that adults and kids are super different, but... I think back then there was a lot more emphasis on this dynamic where they played on this, like, it's us kids versus those adults who won't understand us, don't understand us, can't help us, can't do anything for us type thing. And I think, you know, as a parent, and I see this in movies, I'm like, man, I wish that parents were more an ally for the kids. So when we have Dad telling him, stop daydreaming, start facing your problems, it just, you know, it's just, it obviously is not what he needs. And so,
but that is so indicative of that time. And exactly. I know I mentioned this earlier, but that is exactly. absolutely how I was raised.
Yeah, exactly. So it is indicative of
we've
the time.
Learned so much more about mental health and about how to parent and how to assist our kids through different traumas and things that they and it will be fascinating in 40 years to see if you have children with like this incredible, you have adults with like this incredible mental, you know, stability, or they're just like entitled and incapable.
I know, right? We always like, we think we're doing what's best for our kids. And then when we become like middle-aged, we find out all the ways that we screwed them up. I can't wait. Honestly, I can't wait to see.
Wait to figure out.
It's exciting. So there's other behavioral stuff that should be mentioned. Bastian skips school to read his book, which is something Daphne actually pointed out. She was like, wait, he's not going to school? He's just not going to go because he doesn't want to go. And I was like, dang it.
Yep.
He ends up staying out super late, and we can assume he is out past curfew probably. So his dad.
I don't know that dad would have given him a curfew. Dad didn't seem too involved or seem to care too much.
Yeah, it is a sign of the
dad
times.
Dad was going through his own issues.
Yeah, dad drank a lot of raw eggs at the beginning of that. Yeah. Was crazy. The Sphinx statues, they have boobs, whole boobs.
Yep, and you see a little nip.
Total nips. Scary Spice would have loved these boobs.
Absolutely.
They've got great boobs.
They got great boobs.
But they are not blurred. They're not wearing bras.
I was shocked Michael didn't say anything about that. He literally pointed out every single detail of this movie, and the most boob-obsessed child on planet Earth did not know. I kept waiting and waiting and waiting, and nothing got said.
I actually was thinking about that when you were talking about him being scared of them. I was like, yeah, I thought we would want to curl up in their lap.
Seriously, live with them forever. Yeah, no. Yeah.
So if that makes you uncomfortable, I mean, it's nudity. Straight up stone.
I mean, but
stone carved nudity.
Stone.
Yeah, so if, you know, it's kind of Grecian.
Yeah.
If you're okay with it, we're okay with it.
If Michael made it through the boobs, you guys can make it through the boobs.
If you can walk through a museum of olden times and let your kid look at those paintings,
you'll be fine.
You'll be fine. Yeah. So that's all I had for this movie.
We will be interested to hear what you guys say when you watch this with your kids. And speaking of things to watch with your kids, I have been dying to talk to Laura about a show that I saw on Netflix. In fact, we came across this show after watching The Neverending Story. We just happened to flip on Netflix and this popped up. And I have seen so many articles that my friends have posted about it that I'm like, okay, this is what people are talking about. Straight out of Japan is a show called Old Enough. Netflix has just started airing season one of this show. And what they do is in Japan, they take toddlers. These are itty bitty kids between like 2 and 5 years old.
Yep.
And they send them on their own to run errands. Mm-hmm. And we're talking crossing busy streets, getting on public transit, dealing with machinery, going into stores by themselves, doing everything by themselves, and followed by, of course, cameramen. So they're not totally alone, but they are supposed to do this without any assistance. And then the whole comedy of the show is, do they pull it off or do they screw it up?
Right. Yes.
I did find out this show has actually been on in Japan for 30 years.
Whoa.
This show has been on for so long that now the children of the original children from season one are now on the show.
Jeez.
Yeah. So this is like a staple in Japan that has just come to the U.S. And boy, does it show our cultural differences.
Yes. This show is like Montessori on steroids. Woo! Just give. They can do whatever we can do. They just need the tools.
They just need the tools to do it, and they'll be fine. And if you don't let them, they'll never learn.
Yeah, that's exactly what this show's about. These kids are in diapers.
Literally.
I mean, literally, they're Layla's age. I was trying to imagine Layla doing this. She is nowhere near as cooperative. They have to prep these kids because Layla would have just been like, no, you're coming too. You're coming with me. But these kids are like, all right, I'm going to go run. They must have seen that you say the show has been around for 30 years. I'm sure these kids have. Well, no, they're two.
It's culturally different. So I've done I did some deep dives.
Tell me
on
everything.
This. So first of all, in Japan, and I have not been to Japan, so I'm only doing this from the articles and people that I've spoken with since this show came out that have lived in Japan. And first of all, the cities are made for this sort of thing. Meaning
the city that they're in, or like
all
just
cities
in Japan,
in Japan are built for independence at a young age, meaning things like cars don't park on the side of the road, so you have total visibility. The curbs are lower so kids can get in and out. From a very young age, parents take children, like, first of all, you walk to most of the stuff. There's just way more independence for children at a younger age.
It's more pedestrian friendly.
And just independence overall, as kids are taught, like, to make your own juice with the juicer, and they're taught how to do all of these things so early. And they take them out on walks and do things. And culturally, children are taught at a young age to say hello to everyone they come across. So you know who the person is that runs the store. You know who's driving the bus. You know who the crossing guards are. So there is this, it takes a village mentality. So between 7 and 12, this is totally normal for kids to be 100% on their own, walking themselves to school, going to the store for their parents, taking care of business by themselves. Kidnappings are extraordinarily low. Not saying they don't happen. They're very few and far between in Japan. So again, it was fascinating to watch. Now, the comedy of this show is that, no, two-year-olds are not typically on their own.
Right, right.
But they are here.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, it gave me anxiety because so I'm trying to think of Michael at almost seven having to do any one of these things by himself. No. I mean, I have a kid who can barely dress himself. Like, if I was like, walk to the store and get on a bus and buy me some things, and while you're at it, go over here and drop this off at my friend's house. I mean, some of these like 3-year-olds are being given like 4 and 5 chores.
Yeah.
At different locations.
I know. And I was thinking the same thing. And I'm sure this is taught behavior on my end, but neither one of my kids want to do anything by themselves.
No.
So my kids, my oldest, she will brush her teeth for sure. But she wants me in the bathroom while she's doing it. And like I said, I'm sure it's learned behavior, but I was just sitting there chuckling like, man.
No way.
But I think there is an element of this is a reflection of the culture that – of Japanese culture that, you know, because they are raised differently than our kids. And then the environment at home and the environment, you know, at large is more primed or like built around this type of behavior where kids can do these things.
Can do and do. And it is. It's just a different mindset. Like, I was fascinated by the houses that everyone lives in. The houses are so much smaller. I mean, we have these giant houses here in the United States where, like, you get lost in it. And everything's so much simpler and smaller so that kids can go make their own juice or can go. There was one episode, though, that made me laugh really hard because Zach and I were watching, and Michael, too, just marveling at, like, oh my gosh, this world where kids can do all these independent things. And then one of the episodes, the kid walks into his house and there's literally like crayon and marker on every inch of this house. Like, the cabinets are colored, the walls are colored.
I noticed
everything. And we laughed so hard. It's like, yeah, that wouldn't happen at our house.
No. I saw that too. I was like, whoa.
Wow. That's different.
Aesthetics mean something different in that home than it does in yours.
Yeah. I mean, Remy colored on her bed. She actually wrote, she had a crush on a boy at school, and she was writing, "I love Noah, I love Noah," all over her bed. And she got in trouble for it. Like, we made her clean her bed.
Yeah, that's regrettable, too, because she's not always going to love Noah.
No.
And now she's got this reminder all over
forever, her walls. Because it got stained in there, too.
You're going to have to accompany her to the tattoo place and make sure she's not doing something impulsive. Yeah.
Stuck forever.
That's still a thing, man. I know somebody, a close friend of mine, who tattooed a name on her
regrets.
Body.
Regrets. I know, man. Be careful.
Don't do it. Don't do it. And that was regrettable.
That is regrettable.
The end result was regrettable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so now it's on Netflix.
Yep.
And people can watch it there.
And what do you think? Like, does this make you want to change your mind about how we do things here in the States? Like, it shows that our kids are capable of so much more than what we're letting them do.
I think that was the message I walked away from it, is that our kids are totally capable, you know, and they can do more than what we give them credit for. They just need to have the right tools. But I think that to the extent that they do it in Japan, I don't think that that's...
No, it wouldn't even be safe here. Exactly. Like, we just don't even have... We are not set up in our country to have this... No.
No. But we do have a mini kitchen in our home so that the kids can cut fruit and veggies and things like that. They have a mini fridge. And so I do like that concept quite a bit, and that they are... you know, able to do these things. The minute that they want to do these things, we should let them. I think it's very tempting to just want to do it yourself as a parent, especially because it takes them, you know, if they don't know what they're doing, it takes them a long time to do it, or maybe they don't do it the way that you would do it. And so we as parents, I think we try to help, quote unquote, but then we might end up actually
inhibiting,
or stunting growth. So for example, if I were to cut a banana for my kids, it's going to look like perfect banana slices. If I let Layla cut it, it'll get cut. She will eat it. It just won't look like perfect banana slices.
And that's okay.
And that's okay. She's got to learn somehow. And I think that that is a cool message to have. And you also, and just, you know, if you have the patience for it, letting your kids do things in the kitchen and around the house, I think is a great idea. And it's good to start early, because I think we tend to get frustrated when our kids at 15 aren't keeping their rooms clean, but they probably learned the first 9 years of their lives that their parents are going to walk behind them and clean up after them. And so if you can teach your kid to clean up after themselves at a young age, we're doing that with Daphne right now, then they might be more inclined to clean up after themselves when they are a little bit older.
And I would also add that as a country, it would be nice if we didn't judge parents who are allowing their children to have a little bit more independence. Because I very vividly remember, I think Michael was 2 when I would have him, when I first started having him help me in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I remember I posted a picture on social media where he was flipping bacon.
Oh, yeah.
He was perfectly safe. Like, there wasn't that much oil in the pan. I was standing right there. And oh, my gosh, the comments that I got about, like, the danger that I was putting my child in. And it was like, he's perfectly safe. And same thing, I remember he was helping me pressure wash the patio. And people flipped out. And they were like, you can't. And I had it on low. He was fine. Like, we have to trust that parents are going to be able to take care of their kids. Just because you see someone helping their kid be independent. Like, we as a country could stand to get a little more chill, like Japan.
I think, I think lately, especially, people's brains tend to go to worst case scenario, as does mine at times. I'm guilty of it. But I think that there's something that can be harmful to kids if you are trying to protect them from the threat of harm.
Right.
Or if you are always acting based on worst case scenario, because a lot of times worst case scenario isn't realistic, you know?
And it probably instills anxiety.
It doesn't probably.
Okay. I mean, I would imagine that would make, I mean, that I've seen it with my own eyes when parents are like, oh, no, everything is scary.
Yeah.
And then you have a child that's scared of everything.
You cause a kid to doubt their own capabilities as well. That causes a kid to doubt themselves. It causes a kid to doubt their place in this world and their ability to get things done. And then we have parents complaining that their kids are 30 and still living at home.
Right. And I have to tell you, and it is so hard, because yesterday I picked Michael up from school. He wanted to run to the playground at school. And he's like, I have to show you my new trick. And his trick was to jump from one of the things that you climb on all the way to the other one. And he's pretty high up in the air. And of course, I'm like, when he did it. And I'm like, no. Oh. And he looked at me. He's like, Mom, I'm doing parkour. This is parkour. I'm like, how do you know that word? Who is speaking to you? Why is this a thing? And now that he's obsessed with it, he's like, I just want to do parkour and jump from thing to thing. And I'm like, and there is that like, okay, but I want you to be safe. But yeah. I'm having to like self-talk and be like, Kara, it's okay. Breathe. Yeah. He's not going to do something he can't do. You are going to be there. If it's too scary, you can stop him. So
why do you think parents have so much anxiety now?
Social media. I blame social media.
It's
too much in our face now. Now we see all the things that can go wrong.
So much, too much information, I think.
I know that's what gives me anxiety is you do immediately go to the like, I want to protect my child. I don't want these things. And I don't want to be national news. Like I always think of the gorilla kid, the kid that fell in the gorilla cage. And it's like, oh, I don't want to be that child, that mom who's blamed because my son likes to climb and is adventurous.
Right. Yeah, I do think that you might be right about that, too, is that when a kid does find themselves in a situation where they're injured or making bad, you know, harmful decisions, the blame does tend to go on the parent.
Always.
Even though.
Unfairly.
Even though kids are going to do those things.
Yes.
Yeah. Regardless of how beautifully you parent.
I don't know, it's an interesting show. I think it's a good show that I'm glad they brought it here because it does bring up some really good topics. So
I'm glad you brought it to our show because it's definitely a really cool window into this way of parenting and this way of being as a society, for sure.
And we want to hear what you think. Have you seen Old Enough? Have you seen The Neverending Story?
Yes.
Let us know. You can reach out to us online and all the different places. And please leave reviews. We appreciate your support so much.
Yes, we do. Thank you guys so much for listening. And next week, we are going to cover Carmen Sandiego.
Carmen Sandiego.
The new Carmen Sandiego.
Yeah, not the old one. Mm-hmm. The new one. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if this is going to be as good as She-Ra. I'm ready to dive in.
Ooh, yes.
All right, we'll see you next week.
Subscribe and follow us on Instagram.